Welcome to Inside Whitehall with me, James Starkey. For the course of the election, my usual co-pal is not here, Jonathan Gullis. He's off fighting a seat for the great people of Stoke and Stoke-on-Trent North. So we're going to have a few guests on, and I'm really delighted today to have Harry York, who's the Deputy Political Editor of the Sunday Times, but long time been in the lobby and was at the Telegraph where I first met you, which now I feel like that point when you're getting old, where I think I save people on my phone is where I first met them. And now when I realise how long ago it was you at the Telegraph makes me feel old.
Yeah, definitely getting on a bit now, yeah.
But how long have you been in the lobby, Harry?
God, it must be since Brexit, so... Okay. This is my maths, bad maths here, but yeah, 6-7 years now.
It feels
like a lot's happened in that time. So it feels like it's been longer, but it actually has been quite brief, actually.
It's been jam-packed. Yeah. And so when we always kind of ask people how they got into politics, their job. So what was your, how did you first get into journalism? Mm. And did you always want to be specifically a political journalist, or is that something you kind of fell into?
Yeah, so I actually wanted always to be a journalist from about the age of 20. So my dad was a journalist years ago, mm-hmm. so I had kind of the background growing up, but it wasn't until I got to university that I got really interested in current affairs, and I was studying history anyway, so there's quite a few crossovers there. But I wasn't particularly interested in becoming a political journalist, actually, to begin with. I was really into news and investigations, and I caused quite a nuisance at my university when I was running the student news website there. So I got into the Telegraph as a graduate, and I did general news. So I kind of reported on quite a lot of terror attacks, crime, etc., covered education. But Brexit was the thing for me that really got me thinking, I want to be in the lobby, I want to be a political correspondent, because for 3 years, basically, it was the dominating story. Yeah. And increasingly I found that even with the biggest news stories, they would always have a political element to it. It always would lead back to Westminster. So more and more I felt that that was the right course for me. And then through quite a lot of hard work, I managed to kind of push myself into the lobby team at the Telegraph. Mm.
So when you started covering Brexit, you weren't in the political team?
No, I wasn't. I kind of helped out where best I could. But the referendum was going on, actually, when I started to get involved.
So there might be journalists now, kind of news reporters who maybe, because there'll be people maybe dragged on to help the general election now, I guess.
Yeah,
so
this is a perfect platform for lots of young journalists who want to get in and to make their impression, actually.
Yeah. And so the thing we thought we'd look at today, so I thought what we'd do with not having Jonathan around is, on the election, look at some of the key components of the election, because the point of the pod is always to try and take things that you read and you guys write about, but sometimes aren't well understood. And so I think there's some key components of an election that everyone would recognise, but maybe unpack them a bit. We're going to look at the history of it a bit. And today we thought we'd do debates, because we've had the first one this week. And by the time this airs, we'll have as there's a seven-way debate.
Yes,
we're recording this on a Thursday. Seven-way debate's tomorrow, I think.
Tomorrow night, yeah. I'm probably going to be there, actually.
You're going to go?
Yeah.
So things like that as well, the spin room, which we now get a glimpse of on TV.
We never really used to get so much of that.
No.
I think because it's such a theatrical event, that spin room, they love getting in there now. So.
And that's the thing, they've become a big event, set piece of the election. But maybe have a look at how really important or decisive they are. So we were just talking when you came in. You said to me, have you done your history on this? And we quickly got into working out that debates have been a topic of a conversation. They didn't come until 2010, but they could have come in much, much, much earlier.
Yeah, you could have been watching TV debates in black and white.
Yeah.
Because the first request, I think, for a TV debate in an election was Harold Wilson, when he was Labour leader, hoping to win the keys to Downing Street, and he challenged Alec Douglas-Home to debate in the 1960s, but Douglas-Home said no. And then Wilson got in, and then Wilson was asked for a debate from the opposition leader at the time, which was Edward Heath, who was a Conservative leader. He said no to Heath.
Yeah.
And then I think there was a bit of a lull period where it didn't happen so much. Then we have James Callaghan, who obviously his premiership blew up in a massive way towards the end, 78, 79. And I think he actually asked Thatcher for a debate and she said no.
Yeah.
And then Thatcher gets in. She says no to Neil Kinnock. And you have this back and forth. And then John Major replaces Thatcher after her kind of glorious reign, so to speak, of the Conservative Party. And then Major says no to Kinnock in 1992 when he pulls off that surprise victory. And then we get to 1997 and we've had, I would say, a very comparable period to what we've had recently with the Conservative Party, which is the Tory sleaze scandal of the Major era. Major was on the back row. You know, he was really struggling. He was down in the polls. You had this ascendant figure in Tony Blair. And so I think it was Major who asked for the debate, but it didn't happen and they couldn't agree on a format. So it never materialised. And the rest, so to speak, is history. Blair gets swept in on a landslide. And then it only took off in 2010, as you say. And the reason for that was because Nick Clegg, the then Lib Dem leader, and David Cameron, the leader of the opposition at the time, I think they kind of got together and decided that this was a good idea. And I think a lot of the broadcasters at the time were pushing very hard for this to happen. So in a year before the election, Cameron and Clegg get together and they start talking to the broadcasters. And originally, Gordon Brown, who had replaced Tony Blair at this point, was quite reluctant to do it. You know, he wasn't seen. He was a very skillful figure and powerful figure in the House of Commons when he wanted to be, but I think he was very nervous about doing them, but eventually got pulled in. And so they all came together, and over a series of weeks, they worked out this format for the election, and it was going to be a three-way debate between the three main leaders, and there would be three of them over three consecutive Thursdays, and that's how it all came to be.
And so it's interesting, so you maybe finally got to a point where there was at least something in it for all of the three main leaders by that point, because Brown's maybe a bit on the back foot.
Yeah.
So there's maybe a reason for him to think, let's try something that might change the dice.
Totally.
But Cameron's not, he's not Blair in 97. He's not heading in on a huge poll lead.
No.
So he needs to try and do something. And Clegg's trying to kind of keep the Lib Dems going. So you get this weird situation where there's maybe something in it for all three of them for the first time in that process.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for Nick Clegg, it was definitely a case of, I need to introduce myself to the British public.
Yeah.
I'm the leader of the third party. Not many people know who I am. So here's the platform for me to shine.
And it really worked for him.
It totally worked for Clegg. So if we actually look at the three debates, the first one is where Clegg Mania, as it's now known, started, because he really impressed in that first debate. It was on domestic affairs.
I was watching it this morning.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Well, just from memory, and bear in mind, I was probably still in school at that. I wasn't still in school.
I was 30, but yeah.
But from memory, Clegg really shone out in that debate. And there was this famous moment, actually it was several moments, where both Gordon Brown and David Cameron said that they actually agreed with the positions that Clegg was espousing in the debate. And you had this situation where you had Tory Labour, but then he'd come through the middle as a sensible centrist figure. And so he won. There were lots of polls done and he won by a landslide in that first debate. And the 2010 television debates are remembered for Nick Clegg because of the Clegg Mania effect. But what people forget is actually that in the second debate, Clegg and Cameron basically drew. And in the third one, Cameron won based on all the polling. So there's obviously, there's always been this sense that was the moment, and certainly for an opposition leader, these debates are a huge opportunity. But actually, Clegg didn't do as well in retrospect as people think. And it's also worth just pointing out that when we came to it on polling day, the Lib Dems did put on votes. They put on just shy of 1 million extra votes. But they actually lost seats.
Yeah, they lost five seats.
People forget that about Clegg as well, that he didn't actually gain seats. He lost, as you say, five seats. That was also, I think, a reflection on turnout. But nonetheless, it kind of shows you that even with that incredible success that he enjoyed, it didn't translate.
But we often get these kind of political urban myths, which you kind of get an accepted view. Because I exactly the same as having been at YouGov at the time and was with Joe Twyman, who's now set up his own polling company. But, you know, he would always remind us afterwards that, yes, you know, it was a big factor in the coverage of the election for people, you know, in your profession. And it did introduce Nick, but it's not perhaps as seismic as it's kind of sometimes remembered or like now when people write about it, it's not as seismic as perhaps people remember.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's definitely true. Maybe 2010, it helped him personally. But one thing I would say is I agree that it didn't really impact on the vote share, although it's obviously very difficult to know how it influenced.
Because it could have done worse. It could have been heading to be going worse.
And I think it's very difficult to extrapolate. But what is certainly true is that it did make him a big public figure.
Yeah.
And I remember after the first debate, I think it was Nick Robinson at the time who called it and said, the significance of this is that Nick Clegg is now potentially the man that holds the balance of power. If this is an authoritative figure in the British discourse, and he ended up becoming so.
Yeah.
It's quite prophetic in a way because obviously we got a hung parliament, and I think it was heading towards that anyway during the debates. But but he solidified that was going to happen, and then from then on, he obviously was in a position of authority, and he managed to work out this coalition agreement with David Cameron. So it was interesting in that sense.
Watching it this morning, it caused me to think two things, which is, one, a reminder, and we know this, anyone who's kind of interested in maybe US politics, who've had them for longer since the 60s, famously with Nixon.
Nixon, yes.
again, which people refer to a lot. And just to say, when people refer to that, they often refer to the fact when Nixon took part, he won the radio debate from the polling, but he loses with the TV debate where he's seen as sweaty and
pale.
And then we start to get this change of view in politics, which is how important image is.
Yeah.
Because he seemed to have actually won the debate where people are just listening to the voices, interestingly.
And on the image thing, I think one of the other reasons that Clegg did well was because of how he presented himself.
Yeah.
So Gordon Brown's a bit of an awkward character, and he was seen as such during the campaign trail. Cameron was very much trying to present himself as kind of down with the kids, you know, big society, hug a hoodie. But Clegg was very, very media confident. He looked down straight into the camera, and it was like he was having a conversation with the voter, whereas the other two didn't feel that way. So that was another interesting dynamic.
Watching it, I agree with you, but I think Cameron's in the same bracket. So watching that one back, which Clegg won, I think we know this from the US as well. Debates are so much about kind of preconceived perceptions of people. So no one knows Clegg when you go into the election. So his bar's so low. So he does perform very, very well in that debate. But because no one knows him, he's the clear winner. Watching the debate, I would say Cameron's brilliant in that debate as well. And Cameron is just as assured and talking to the voter. But the dynamics are that David's in the middle, Brown's off to the left of him, and Clegg's off to the right, kind of almost at the side of both of them. They end up in this, they want to attack each other as the two main parties vying to, you know, vying to be the next PM. So Clegg gets to sweep in, and as you say, then say kind of quite reasonable things.
Yeah, he's the voice of reason.
He's clearly the voice of reason. They keep saying, I agree with him. But actually, Cameron, when you now looking back on it, you look at David and Nick, and the big contrast is actually between them two and Gordon.
Yeah.
Gordon is the less comfortable media performer, less polished, looking for TV. Cameron and Clegg are younger, kind of a bit more vibrant looking, way more comfortable, as you say, with that format of talking directly to the voter. Even have a kind of style of speech that makes them sound kind of grown up and professional, but more relatable.
Yeah, definitely.
And Gordon sounds very much like a politician, really on top of his detail, and maybe comparable perhaps to two of our current leaders.
Definitely.
But not as friendly, not as quite relatable, for want of a better word.
No, I think that's a very good way of putting it, actually.
And so they've now become a fixture, and we've had them in subsequent elections, referendums, and I assume that's a big part. You know, you'll know this. The media now expect them, so it's you. Would you say it's almost impossible, even for whoever's the kind of most powerful in that dynamic? Whether now it's Keir, probably, you know, he's sitting on a 20-point lead. He has the most to lose. He's probably going to be prime minister, etc. So he'd be the guy in the position maybe in previous times to say, nah, don't fancy this. It's only downside for me. But now that he has to do a couple, right?
You do. And the reason why he has to do a couple is because of the example and the precedent set by Theresa May in 2017. Because, so we had this situation in 2015 where Cameron and Clegg did, sorry, not Clegg, well, yes, Clegg too, but Miliband, they did take part in kind of a seven-way debate, but they did individual interviews. And there was obviously that famous, hell yes, I'm tough enough from Miliband and Paxman, which to this day still makes me laugh. But then we get to 2017 and Theresa May's obviously got this huge poll lead. And again, it's all history now, but she called the snap election a surprise election. But it all started to go terribly wrong for her very quickly. And to compound that, I think, for TV debates, she decided not to take part. She did
take Amber Rudd.
She sent Amber Rudd to deputise for her. She did take part in an Andrew Neil grilling and a Paxman grilling. But what happened was she'd left this void. And as you say, Rudd did a very good job deputising for her, but could not hide the fact that Theresa May was seemed to be running scared. And all the other leaders made a point of that. And even Jeremy Corbyn, who missed, I think, the first debate, he then, on the hoof, announced he was coming to the second. So it really didn't work for her. So to go back to your question, that's why I think Keir Starmer can't be seen to be ducking a debate, because it's just too much of an open goal for Rishi Sunak. So, yeah, he's definitely had to take part, even though he's so far ahead.
Because I think... I think I touched on it with Jonathan last time, but he's obviously restrained in maybe how much he can speculate on things being the actual deputy chairman. But I think it's true to say, well, tell me if I'm wrong, you know, you'll be more balanced on this than me. It's true to say that if I speak to people at CCHQ, they'd put Rishi up almost pretty much every week for debate because they're on the back foot. They want to drag Keir onto more debates. There's currently a... If I'm right, there's only one more scheduled.
There's one more. I think it's on the 26th of June.
I can't remember. Sky have confirmed they're attending, but that's they're not. Is that?
I think it might be some sort of share. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe it's a share. They've done it in the past with Channel 4. So maybe it's that kind of setup with the broadcasters. But yeah, to answer your question.
Rishi would do as many as almost you could throw at him. Is that?
But he has to.
Yeah.
He obviously thinks he's a very assured performer in these debates. And obviously, if we're getting into the first debate, on Tuesday, he came out all guns blazing. And yes, he does. I think he's been very keen to impress on people because he's not had necessarily an easy ride whilst he's been Prime Minister. Because the only other snapshot that people see of him really is on broadcast clips and Prime Minister's questions. And obviously, to be honest, for most of the 2 years he's been Prime Minister, he's had to deal with some pretty horrendous mishaps and mistakes and errors. So Starmer has often had an open goal and plenty of ammunition to go at him with, whereas in a one-to-one format where you've not got MPs jeering and trying to put you off, that's where CCHQ felt that Sunak could excel. And, you know, if we're going into the actual debate itself now, he obviously did come out very strong. He was very confident and self-assured. And I think if you looked at Keir Starmer's body language, he seemed to be a little bit more nervous because he's obviously got far more to lose here. Keir's got a lot to lose, whereas Rishi Sunak has got very little to lose. He has everything to gain. And I think that is actually definitely true. I've been speaking to a few people around Starmer over the last few days, and I think he was very nervous before the debate. I think he has quite a special routine to prepare for them, to collect himself. And you could just see that in the opening stages. And I think where Sunak took such an early advantage is he had this single line, the tax line, the 2000
The 2000
tax.
Claim.
And I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit later on. And he just went for him straight away on it.
He looked shocked by that a little bit. Or he certainly didn't feel sure-footed enough to immediately kick back.
No, exactly. And obviously that's all everyone's been talking about for the last few days is why did he not shut it down quickly?
Yeah.
I think the reality for Keir as well was that the format doesn't necessarily suit his type of speaking or debating. He tried to, in a format which only allowed 45 seconds each, to give quite complex responses, but admittedly to complicated subjects, right? And he got shut down and he didn't have time. And I think some people think he actually did have a proper rebuttal on the two K tax line. I think, you know, there's been this letter that's been released from the Treasury.
The Permanent Secretary of the Treasury.
There's some suggestion that he actually was about to talk about that, but then he got cut off.
So what's in this? Why is the letter? You have to write about these things. Yeah. Why is that letter important?
The letter's important because Rishi Sunak has said that an independent analysis done by Treasury civil servants shows that Labour's going to hike everyone's taxes by £2,000. Now, the actual calculations themselves are very contentious and have been rightly scrutinised over the last couple of days since the debate. There's lots of suggestions you cannot possibly give a figure of £2,000 per household because of it's a very crude arithmetic that they've applied here. Mm. But the clear and utter controversy in all of this is the fact that they claimed it was done by independent civil servants. Now, this letter that came out afterwards was from the Permanent Secretary of the Treasury, and it said, in black and white terms, because there was other analysis not done by civil servants but by outside organisations, you could not say that this was the work of civil servants, yet the Prime Minister repeatedly did so.
Mm. And so that's the kind of controversy. Because I'll give you a small anecdote, I don't know if you heard this. I won't identify them because not obviously not fair on them. I was talking to someone in Labour when they're, because some of these, one or two of these analysis, they were requested a long time ago. So the kind of background is the party of government is allowed to request a civil service analysis, treasury analysis, on opposition party policies. Yeah. That is a legitimate course.
They've been doing it since Nigel Lawson's day.
And so Labour got the first one. So what happens apparently is the Permanent Secretary, I assume James Bowler, or I think they've got two at the Treasury, calls up Labour and says, look, just so you know, in the next couple of days, we're going to publish this particular whatever policy it was. And they say, oh, really? Is this allowed? This is outrageous. You know, you can't do this. And they said, well, just to remind you that in 2010, Gordon Brown did the same thing to the Conservative Party. And they laughed and said, yeah, fair enough.
Well, this is the point. Yeah.
That bit, there might be some contention over it and how it's done. That bit is allowed. And it all, as you say, I saw that, I think Gus O'Donnell has said this shouldn't happen.
Yeah,
but I assume he was also in the civil service when they did do it to the Tory ones. So there's a bit, so whatever anyone says, this process has been going on a while.
Oh, yeah. Both parties, when they've been in government, have used it and weaponized it against their opposition. It's just a case of, I think the debate now, because it's...
But the big thing is, what they didn't say is, factually, is this is what it translates into a tax for the... They said, all they say, as far as I know, is, you've given us this policy, based on this information, it's going to cost this in Treasury analysis terms.
Yeah.
Here you go. That's it.
But we had this in 2019 and 2017. I remember reporting, or certainly receiving, briefings from the Conservative Party about Corbyn's manifesto, and it was going to cost £1.2 trillion.
Yeah.
Pounds. But that was very much, I think, badged as CCHQ work rather than Treasury work, presumably because it was probably not true. And they couldn't get the civil servants to sign off on it.
Yeah.
But this isn't new, as you say, and there is a question, even if he did get shut down and he had an answer, he should have been ready. He should have had a concise 30 to 45 second answer ready to go on that, and he didn't. People like me have come in for a lot of criticism because I pointed this out on Twitter that he should have shut it down because some people were suggesting, oh, he let him lie. He let Sunak lie so that Labour could release the letter the next day.
I don't believe that.
I don't believe that either. I don't think you would ever, as a media handler, allow a lie to circulate if you consider it to be a lie. But I think it does, there are legitimate questions about, well, how should the media report on those claims? Because
it's hard for you though, because
it's really hard.
You'll get criticised by my friends in the Conservative Party if you say, this is definitely not true. Because they'll say, well, no, the analysis that's done on the cost of policies, and if you break it out by 18 million households, this is how much it costs per household.
Yes.
So you can't say it's totally not true. So you'll get...
You can't win either way.
You can't win either way.
And what what I guess I want to stress to anyone listening to this is that it's almost as though whether the figure or not is true, that is very important. And I think journalists in the hours after the debate, the next day, did go out and properly drill into whether this is accurate or not. Mm. And it was all over the websites. It was prominently covered the next day.
Mm.
But it's difficult for us as reporters because we cannot ignore the almost in an election, it's about the leaders. How are they able to react? How are they able to lead? How are they able to present themselves?
Mm.
And the story, the reason why it got so much traction, it was on the front pages, I think, was because people were so amazed that Keir Starmer didn't respond effectively to it. So that's almost a story in itself.
Yeah.
That's why it's generated so much controversy.
And then, because I'm sure you've covered this as well, it's also because you get caught in the, because I noticed watching even some of the immediate spin room kind of chat when the broadcast journalists had the Labour spinners on, who I think it was Liz Kendall and
Ashworth.
John Ashworth.
Sparkle.
And they were saying to them, well, you've said they're going to cost $39 billion because they want to get rid of national insurance. That's not true. That's not their policy. Yeah. And you're saying that. So, and I think when Labour have called Tories liars,
if I'm
in CCHQ, I'm going to say, well, if you're going to write anywhere that we're lying about this, they're lying about, they're at least equally lying about that.
That's true. I can't recall, can you, if Keir Starmer then wheeled out the $71 billion figure? I don't think he did.
I don't remember him saying
so
that.
So I guess you could say that he has the moral high ground because he did, but his party but Labour still
have.
Own it. Yeah,
front bench is definitely
his party has still pumped that figure out. So both sides are playing the same game. It's just, if you're looking at this objectively, you could argue that cynically, Sunak was more ruthless in using it and exploiting it.
And so, you know, on that kind of general topic, on the debate, what we always get is the winners and the losers. I would say there's been a bit of a mix of polls. There's certainly, I personally think Rishi won that debate. Mm. I thought he really got Keir on the doctors. And when he said, challenged him about, well, you know, they want 35%. You said you're not going to give 35%. What is it? And Keir really couldn't say because Labour won't say what it is. Some would say for understandable reasons. And on pensioners, I think he landed the two biggest blows with the 2000s.
Yeah, he did. He hammered home the retirement tax issue. And again, it didn't feel like Starmer had an answer. But that's because, If you're trying to be fair to the Labour Party, they're in an economic straitjacket. They're so terrified of being seen to not have fully costed all of their proposals that they have left open these holes for the Tories to exploit. But they still believe that even though that allows the Tories to go after them, that economic competence and being seen as a safe pair of hands will ultimately be more beneficial to them among voters than those attacks working. So, yeah.
But it wasn't, what I would also say, it wasn't, we're not going back to Clegg Main, it wasn't Clegg. Clegg, I think, when I had a quick look, I think in that first one, Clegg, 61% of people thought Clegg won. I think it was like 17 Brown, 19 Cameron. It was a very, very clear, three-way split, but it was a very clear Clegg victory. I think the polls have been mixed. The first snap poll, perhaps by YouGov, gave it to Rishi. There's been ones that have suggested it's Keir since.
Yeah.
It's a bit more mixed.
Yeah, so I mean, the immediate poll, as you say, it's quite interesting because of the question that's asked is also really important.
This is
so
a really
the YouGov
point.
Poll said, put your personal preferences or political preferences aside.
Mm.
Who do you think won? And it's always quite interesting. Sam Friedman, who is a very shrewd observer of politics on Twitter, you may disagree. I think he is, personally.
Okay.
He made the point that actually, when you poll people, respondents are often very compliant. You probably know this from your days at YouGov. But then when the next day's polling came in, you had the Savanta poll that put Starmer, I think, 5 points ahead.
Mm.
But then JL Partners, another polling firm, they explicitly made the point of not asking respondents to put their preferences aside. And Starmer won, I think, by 20 points.
20 points, yeah.
So it just shows you. But there was this debate going on about, well, look, given that the Conservative Party's down on the low 20s in the polls, then there's no way on any metric that Sunak should be winning in that debate. So I think you're right. For balance, I think he clearly has impressed. And I think the debate, if it's not done anything else, it doesn't seem to have with the polls yet, if it's done nothing else, it's just calmed some jitters amongst Conservative MPs who have been terribly, terribly frustrated and increasingly angry at the way the campaign has been playing out.
And probably a range of other things, I think.
And many other things.
And even the timing of the campaign, perhaps. Yeah. But what I would say, that I was thinking about this, watching, because I think it relates to the Clegg point as well, watching the debates and looking at Nigel Farage coming in as well. Mm. So we have seen a bit of a jump in Reform polling.
Yeah.
But the big thing, so the background is, when I spoke to someone from CCHQ last week, they said, we really want to get on the tax stuff. Mm. We forced them to rule out VAT increases, the Labour Party. And so they kind of put out a Jeremy Hunt press release, I think, to the dailies and said, oh, Labour are going to put a VAT, which forced Reeves to say, no, that's not true.
So they're tax and spend trapping them.
And I think it's a clear, who knows if it works, but I think what is true is this is a plan of CCHQ's. And I'm told the manifesto next week is going to have some tax things as well to play into the same theme. What that debate definitely did, undoubtedly, is if their plan was to make tax a central theme of discussion, that definitely worked.
They have. And I've spoken to some very senior people in the party over the last few days who tell me absolutely they have made tax the dividing line. It will be very interesting to see how the two manifestos compare, as you say. And actually, just there has been lots of building up to this in terms of the tax trap that the Tories have been trying to set for Labour. If you've looked at the fiscal events that we've had, you know, the NICS cuts.
Yeah.
We had the IMF saying we cannot afford as a country to cut taxes, but the Tories cut taxes, Jeremy Hunt cut NICS in the budget and then the autumn statement. And obviously the big problem for Labour is there is no fiscal headroom to deal with many of the issues that they're going to have to grapple with should they become the government. For example, one of the biggest ones being that the government has built in, the Conservatives have built in just 1% increase in departmental spending after 2025. Mm. Now, you've got all the public sector pay review bodies, they've now submitted their pay recommendations to government, and the government has deliberately not said what they've recommended.
Right.
But the junior doctors are obviously still striking. They want 35%, but I imagine these pay review bodies are going to recommend pay rises way above 1%. So one of the first things that Rachel Reeves might have to deal with is coming into office and finding out that teachers have been recommended a 5% pay rise. Nurses have been recommended 4%. And that all amounts to, you know, £6 to £10 billion of extra spending. And there is no money.
There's no money. And so watching the debate this week, as someone who, you know, covers politics, what do you think, whether or not putting aside winning and losing the debate, what do you think the thing that Keir was trying to most land on Sunak or on the Tory party?
That's a good question. I think he was just constantly trying to say to the voters, just remember how bad it's been. Yeah. You know, look at, and what was interesting as well was he really was, Sunak ended up copying him in this regard, but he tried to empathise with the questioner. And then Sunak didn't do that to begin with.
I saw that out the blocks, Keir was much better at that, I thought. It was like actually watching this one, it was more like David and Nick Clegg.
It's a technique that he clearly had been told to do, but he did it well. And it was what he was trying to say is, I am on your side, this guy isn't. And he tried to get some of the lines in there. He tried to make him look out of touch. He talked about non-doms. That's obviously a nod to Rishi Sunak's wife and her tax status. He talked about, it was very telling as well when they were asked the private healthcare question that immediately, I would never use private healthcare, because he's just trying to, I think he was just always trying to paint the Tories as out of touch. Mm. But he did also miss some opportunities, I felt.
Okay.
I mean, we didn't really hear much about the pandemic or the PPE scandals that went on. We didn't really hear, he tried a lot of attack lines on this trust.
Yeah.
But we didn't hear much about Partygate, for example, and Boris Johnson. So I just thought there were some things that I thought would be there, you know, kind of like a best hits reel to choose from, but they didn't come up.
Mm. Some of those things are maybe like slightly harder to land than this straight tax line. They're kind of, not to say that they're the wrong thing to do. I mean, in terms of Keir playing defensive, maybe it is the best thing to do is just say, well, these guys have had 14 years, you know, come on, I think he's probably said change quite a lot. I'm going to take a guess.
Yeah, he did.
And so that's maybe the easy. So having covered them, they've done this because they don't happen in isolation. So they're definitely going to have at least one more, as we said. So he's going to go into the next one. They know the 2000's coming.
Yeah.
I assume they're going to, the Tories aren't going to back away from it, I'm guessing. They don't seem to be so far from what I can tell.
No, I think Starmer will try and weaponize that now and almost turn that on his head.
Okay.
Because the figure and the source of the figure is now massively under scrutiny.
Mm.
And this letter that they've got their hands on from the Permanent Secretary is not good for the Prime Minister, because honesty is a recurring theme over the last 5 years with Boris Johnson, with Liz Truss, with all the cabinet resignations, etc. And he will make this an issue on trust, I think. And he will turn around and he'll say, last week or however many weeks ago, you claimed this, you said it to millions of viewers. It was a lie, wasn't it, Prime Minister? Mm. This is the truth. And then I think Sunak might be in a difficult position there. So maybe the 2000 tax line would have percolated enough for it to have been worth Sunak's while.
Yeah.
But I also do think that question of honesty, people do think, I do think they consider Starmer to be more of an honest broker than they necessarily think Rishi Sunak and his Conservative Party to be. So that could be quite an interesting dynamic in that debate.
Why don't I challenge you? Tell me I'm wrong. I'd be quite comfortable with that if I was with Rishi, because the document is based on a series of Labour policies that Labour have said. Those policies have been costed by the Treasury. That bit is true. So I'd just read out the cost of those and say, you call me a liar. Which of these are you not going to do?
Yeah.
Right? Because also the baseline is for Labour, when they first started bringing out these documents, Labour tried to say, well, the costings are wrong. The problem with that is, if they go into government, the costings are done by the people who's going to cost their budget.
Yeah.
So the costings, they might not agree with the costings in the same way that Liz Truss doesn't like the OBR, but nonetheless, Liz Truss had to have the OBR score her budget. I mean, it didn't work out very well, admittedly, but you see my point. And so,
no, Liz Truss didn't get the OBR to score.
Well, she didn't, but she they did
that
it
was
eventually.
The whole problem.
They did it eventually.
They did eventually, yeah.
But my point is, you can't avoid it in the same way that I think it's unlikely that Rachel Reeves is going to take a Liz Truss approach and deliver a budget without the OBR doing it.
Yeah.
But whether or not she did it immediately, they would, right? In the same way, and in the same way, the scorecard's going to be done by the Treasury officials.
I get that, but the problem that you've got, James, here is that the actual maths. So you're right, but then Rishi Sunak has got to explain how the figures are arrived at. The figure is basically Labour, the Tories have worked out, or the civil servants, or whoever they've kind of lumped together to get this figure. It's 38.5 billion of spending.
Yeah.
Spending commitments. And the Tories have basically taken away Labour's, what they will raise from their extra taxes, the non-DOMs, the windfall tax, etc. And they've subtracted it from their spending commitments, and that's what's left over.
Mm.
And then they've done this incredibly crude maths, which is you divide it by 18 million households.
Mm.
And then you don't get to 2,000, you get to £500, I think, per year, but then you times it by four, and you give a four-year total. So that 2,000 figure is a four-year total.
Sounds pretty accurate to me.
Starmer should have probably made that clear as well, but he probably will do.
But then you're accepting the premise.
Around. Yeah, well, you're not necessarily accepting the premise, because you're making out, whilst if Starmer's explaining it, he's making the Prime Minister look like he was misleading. And if Sunak is explaining it, the other thing that Starmer could turn around and do and say, okay, guess what? I've taken your maths and I've applied it to your tax policies.
Yeah.
Fraser Nelson at The Spectator, I think everyone can agree, very respected columnist, but he's not a friend of Sir Keir Starmer's.
Mm.
He says in a piece that he wrote yesterday that if you use the same methodology and you apply it to the Tories' current tax policies, then everybody's £3,000 worse off in 4 years' time. Now, if you're Keir Starmer, you put that to Rishi Sunak, what does Rishi Sunak say back?
So I think that's a challenge. I definitely agree with that. I don't know how they're going to... They'll have to come up with something for that.
Yeah.
But I think on the Keir stuff, I think the difficulty is... Let me put it more generally across both of them.
Mm.
The difficulty for both, but it includes Keir on the 2000 claim, is that you've got people like the IFS Institute for Fiscal Studies.
Fiscal Studies, yeah.
So the IFS, and if they're listening, forgive me if I paraphrase it wrong, but broadly I think this is right. People like them and many other kind of economists are saying, who are very, very neutral groups of people, are saying both parties, because of what's baked into the budget, as you said, the 1% increases, the 20 billion cuts down in 5 years, both parties are not being completely straight. There's not really any money here. They're promising to do certain things, whether that's the Labour's or the Tories, and that's going to cost something. So either debt is going to go up, which is an issue potentially for the markets.
Yeah.
Either cuts are going to be made to public services or taxes are going to go up or a variation.
Yeah. Those,
and neither party is really coming and telling you what's going on in that area. And so that's not to defend Sunak, because as you say, I think Keir can level that, as Fraser's pointed out, at the Tories. But underlying what I think neither of them can say, but certainly just on the Keir issue with the 2,000, because it's been so contentious this week, I think the problem he's got by saying it's completely not true is lots of people are saying, well, there's some truth in it, because there is these commitments you've made. We don't know where the money's... Is it coming from debt cuts or tax? You haven't said that. So
that's
what allowed Sunak into that area, I think.
That is totally true. And you're right, that's an accurate summary of what Paul Johnson at the IFS says. Because it's impossible, I think, for the Labour Party to come into government and enact the spending cuts that the Conservatives have baked in. Because I think it's £35 billion after 2025.
I thought it was 20, so 35, yeah.
I think it's 35, it might be 25, forgive me if it's the lower figure. How the Labour Party could do that on public spending is impossible. So what Paul Johnson, I think, is saying is that because Labour has shut off so many tax raising areas, and they've shut down the big three, I think, which is VAT, NICS, and income tax.
And corporation tax, I think.
And I think corporation tax. Yeah. How are you going to reverse the spending cuts? And that's the question. That's the question. Because they either say, we will proceed with these spending cuts, that is going to go down like a nuclear bomb with the trade unions and their base. Or they've got to say where they're going to pay for all of this.
And I think the other problem that that Keir's really got, which is just because of the dynamics of election, and this might be very unfair to Labour, but it's a fact, is that no one really thinks that Rishi Sunak's going to be Prime Minister in 5 weeks.
No.
And so
But we also have to... That's a good point, but we do have to... For balance, and I'm trying to be balanced here, there are also already... The Conservative Party's election announcements in the last few days have just been one spending announcement after another, and they still... I mean, they've been in government and they haven't clearly defined where the spending cuts are coming from after 2025. They've just said, this is how much we're going to lop off public spending. They haven't said where. And they've been announcing some pretty expensive policies over the last few days. You can be guaranteed that the manifesto is going to have some really expensive policies in it. And I think, for balance, as you say, both parties, based on their existing plans, have got problems. But I think the Conservatives are going to go that much further. For the reason you just said, it's because the Conservatives know that the likelihood of them actually having to implement it is very, very, is very low.
But I think you might think this is unfair. But my sense of the lobby and journalists in general is they absolutely when they get Sunak on a TV interview, whether it's he sits down with you with the Sunday Times or with Chris Mason at BBC, they will say, look, this is what the IFS say about your plans and da-da-da, and where are you going to make these cuts, and you've made these promises. But I think in the back of their minds is, I'm not sure this guy's going to have to do it. I think with Labour, it's like there's a switch, I think, which is for a long time in opposition, they say things and they said the 28 billion and people go, it's in 2 years. It actually looks like Tory's probably going to win the next election. Let's have a look at it, but da, 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 da. And they've obviously, and it's no surprise that as they came down the home straight into this year, when they're leading the polls by 20 points in what we knew was an election year, even if we didn't know it was going to be a summer election, is that there's a lot more scrutiny and saying, well, are you really going to do 28 billion every single year? And Where's that? You know, when you do your sit down for Rachel Reeves, you're much more like, where's that money going to come from? And it's like, well, it's investment. I think the journalists suddenly go, no, you've got to give me a better answer than that.
That's definitely
true.
And
so that's what Keir suffers from now is, I think there's a, and I mean this as a compliment to the journalist.
Victim of success.
There's a like, yeah. No, we know you probably are going to win now.
Yeah.
And there's a few things you haven't, I don't feel you've been straight with the electorate with. So it sounds unfair, but we're actually going to push you a bit harder. Because you're probably going to be Prime Minister in 5 weeks and you're probably going to be Chancellor. And you need to tell Sunday Times readers or BBC viewers or ITV, you need to tell them what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think that helps look Tories with attacks, to be frank. And I think it's a bit of a challenge for Labour.
It is. And that is actually right that we apply, I think we should always apply scrutiny, but it is an inevitable consequence of a party becoming more likely to be the next government that we feel, it's not just that we feel more duty bound to scrutinise their plans. We should always feel duty bound to scrutinise their plans. It's that the interest in the party becomes that much greater, both amongst the electorate and among newspapers. I'm just being honest there. So we do have to stress test their policies that bit more. But also on that 28 billion figure, that was, I think, their retreat from that was both a combination, again, in fairness to them, was a combination of more scrutiny and the Conservatives really, really pushing it.
Hammering it, yeah.
Really hammering it, but also a fact, there was a change in the economic circumstances because interest rates and inflation was going up and so much of our debt is index rated and index linked. So there was just a natural need to change course. But you could argue that they should have seen the economic headwinds a long time ago. They should never have come out with the policy. But that's politics,
I think,
isn't it?
I mean, not to get too much off subject, but I think you saw this a little bit with Corbyn. I think in 17, at first, people, Corbyn was treated by the media as like, this guy's never going to be prime minister, right? So he's promising to nationalise all these things and blah, 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 and we'll have him on. And don't get me wrong, he was definitely interrogated. I think everyone saw that. And I think we know from Twitter that Corbyn supporters definitely felt he was interrogated.
Yes.
But I think the truth is in 19, people said, hang on, this guy could actually be prime minister. So we really need to scrutinise this. And they had an incredibly ambitious manifesto.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone denies it was ambitious.
His supporters would say it was delivered.
It's an understatement.
After they produced their costings for the manifesto, when John McDonnell briefed people like me on his costings, I think it was 2 days later he agreed to a 55 billion commitment on the WASPI women for the pensions.
Right.
So just to give you an idea, £55 billion on top of what they'd already said. I think in total it was £600 billion worth of spending commitments in that manifesto. But you're right. I mean, as you say, I do think Corbyn got on in both elections because, frankly, from the moment he was running to be Labour leader, he was being very heavily scrutinised by journalists. And then I think the difference between 2017 and 2019 is that with Corbyn, the anti-Semitism row in the Labour Party had just been running for so long.
Mm.
And also, the stakes were that much higher in the 2019 election because it was the Brexit election.
Yeah.
And so he did just come under that much more scrutiny because Labour had got themselves into a terrible, terrible position on Brexit, and so he came unstuck on that.
And so to flip into more fun parts of it, as we said near the top, we see a bit more of the spin room. So most people, I mean, people will catch glimpses of it because it was covered on ITV, and as we were saying, they're interviewing people in there, and there's a little bit more discussion even during the broadcast of the debate of the spin room. But you know, we mainly focus on the big debates, and most people listening have probably never been in a spin room. So, how does it operate? Like, it feels a bit like, I don't know, almost like from a TV prep, a bit West Wing or something. Like, it sounds quite fun.
It is.
Is it particularly glamorous? Or
it's definitely not glamorous.
It's not glamorous.
It's not glamorous. It's just a bunch of journalists and shadow cabinet ministers frantically going around briefing journalists, making really terrible jokes. Jonathan Ashworth is atrocious when it comes to jokes. I hope you won't mind me saying that, but it's true. And it's basically a rebuttal unit. So So journalists are sat there watching Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak debate.
When just a question. When the debate's on. So it's all going on. At that point, is anyone trying to spin you, or is everyone just, you know, when he say makes this 2,000 claim, it's like that happens. And then, as we said, there would have been this in multiple debates. Keir hasn't kind of come out and snapped it down. Is there anyone in the spin room noticing that and then getting around?
Yeah, or? There is, but not so much. The commotion's quite quiet because people are concentrating. Right. So the journalists have to take down all their content. So just to say, I wasn't in the spin room for this one, but I've been in many previously.
Been in a lot.
And what you tend to do is maybe someone would come over to you and whisper in your ear and say something. That's been my experience in the past. And it's just afterwards.
Right.
To be honest, the shadow cabinet and the cabinet ministers who are present during the debate, they're getting lots of updates on their phones from the media handlers in the Conservative Party and Labour Party, telling them the line to take for afterwards.
Yeah.
And then after the debate's concluded, that's when the melee starts. And and you have this feeding frenzy of people like Michael Gove popping up left, right and centre, doing interviews to camera. And then others are, you know, journalists are interacting with the shadow cabinet and taking on the record quotes, but often quite a lot of, for people like me, it's a useful exercise because lots of people want to talk to you off the record about what they really thought.
So you can do that. So the environment, we touched on this before, we've done episodes on the lobby, but on the record is they're named as Liz Kendall says X.
Yeah.
Off the record, it might be like a Labour source says this. Yeah. So in that room...
We should stress that we're not suggesting Liz Kendall.
I'm not pointing fingers at Liz Kendall. I particularly remember her popping up. Or Michael, although... Yes. That brings its whole own discussion, but in the room, are there lobby rules in operation? How do you know? So someone comes over to you and says, "Harry, you know,
it's just you set the terms with each individual person, especially as a print journalist, because I've not got a camera in front of me.
Yeah,
you'll just have that conversation with them and say, do you want that on or off the record?
Right.
What have you got to say? They may say, let's have an off the record, but
they'll kind of tell you that this is going to be an off the record chat.
Although, to be fair, it's quite risky to have an off the record conversation in a room like that because there's lots of people and lots of ears.
Yeah,
so you want to be a bit careful there.
Yeah, and so the spin room, they're definitely a part of it all. Do they help shape things? So you've got the broadcast going on, but you've got a lot of you guys. I mean, the debate this time finished at 10.
Yeah,
so that's tight on deadline. So. They really are. I text someone in the lobby and they're like, I'm literally, you know, they were like, I'm just finishing it. And then I looked at my phone on the paper they worked for and it was there. So it must have gone from their computer online pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's true. So basically the way to think of it is when these big debates happen, from a newspaper perspective, you've got a team of journalists. So what you'll have, to use some technical language, is an anchor.
Okay.
So a journalist who may not even be at in the spin room, who's watching the debate from their newspaper's newsroom.
Right.
And they're taking down all of the main stuff. And they'll be writing. The reason why they're called the anchor is because they're writing basically the text.
Right.
Of the front page story and maybe the inside pieces. And then what you'll often get with the journalists, this is especially true of the daily newspapers, is the journalists in the spin room will be hoovering up all the best quotes and lines that they can get. And then often they will send those over to the anchor, who then throws it all into the main story.
Puts it together.
So it's quite an impressive operation, actually. And as you say, given that these debates taking place at 8 p.m., you have to do it. You have to get your stories written incredibly quickly. Mm. We're talking maybe half an hour, sometimes even less. I think... Maybe my memory's playing tricks with me, but I seem to recall when I was at the Telegraph years ago, we had an election TV debate where we actually had to file the front page halfway through the debate for the first edition.
Mm.
And then we had to completely rewrite it once the debate had finished for the second edition. So they're the kind of time constraints that we're working under. And you have to make some very snap judgments.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge.
And do you think the kind of spinners... The media handlers, the kind of spads and pads, and the, you know, the principals, since we've mentioned it, Liz Kendall, John Ashworth, Michael Gove, do they have an impact on the coverage, or is it just getting quotes in? Can they actually shape how it ends up getting, you know, can they move it from Keir actually did a bit better than we thought?
No, not in my experience. I mean, I don't think any amount of spin from any of those people would have changed the narrative on the night on Tuesday. It was very, because you've got to focus on the main the main stage event, which was Rishi Sunak versus Keir Starmer. And all they're trying to do is damage limitation.
Right.
So, for example, for Keir Starmer's side, his team were pumping out, Jonathan Ashworth, Liz Kendall and the rest of them, were pumping out that this is garbage, this 2009 is garbage, because they're hoping that they can get that quote into the front page coverage of all the newspapers, so at least there's a rebuttal in there in case it wasn't clear enough in Keir Starmer's answers.
Yeah.
So that's the only, that's the utility of it. But beyond that, you're never really going to change the headlines.
Okay, so it's useful. Because I did get a text from a weary, let's say somewhat cynical, maybe, person on the Tory side, who's texted me, I think they must have been on the way up, and said, there's absolutely no point in the lobby coming up here. I don't know why they bother. They could cover all this from London. Mm. We don't all need to traipse up here. But they're, do you think that's fair?
I'm going to let you in very partially into a personal anecdote which totally rebuts that argument. So in the last leadership election, the Tory leadership election, when it was Rishi Sunak versus Penny Mordaunt and Liz Truss, I was in, I believe it was the Sky newsroom, or it may have been Channel 4, and it wasn't the newsroom, sorry, it was the spin room.
Yeah.
And it was a debate where Penny Mordaunt was being asked about her views on trans people and self-identification.
Yeah.
And she was being attacked by Liz Truss on one hand and Kemi Badenoch on the other.
Yeah.
And she said that she had never supported, whilst in government, self-ID.
Mm.
And Kemi Badenoch, who was then the Equalities Minister, and Liz Truss, who had been the Equalities Minister before her, both said, that's not true. And just remember, you're on national television.
Yeah.
And after the debate in the spin room, and I'm not going to say how I got it or who approached me, but what I will say is, via my presence in that spin room, the next morning I received a government document which had in black and white quotes and instructions from a civil servant which said that Penny Mordaunt did support self-ID.
Which is quite explosive in that campaign.
Which was a front page story, and 3 days later she was out of the race.
Yeah.
And so that would not have come about.
Right.
If I had not been there. And Harry Cole's book on Liz Truss actually talked about this incident. Mm. And but Harry actually got the source wrong. He tried to out my source.
Okay.
In the end, he didn't name them, but he got the wrong source anyway.
Oh, really? Cost and exposure was Harry's book.
Yeah. So that's a very long-winded way of saying your person is wrong and we should definitely be there. Journalism is always about, as much as possible, being in the room.
Mm.
Be in the room, be present, because you will find gold dust by being somewhere.
And probably, I think you get more of a sense of what... Because I think on that, you probably get... Having been in those similar situations, as cool as you might be, sometimes you portray when your side or your person has maybe slipped up. Like, if I was a journalist, I'd want to try and read what each side is doing.
Yeah, and you can
doing.
Get the body language.
Get the body language.
Yeah, and there was definitely a lot of that during the last Tory leadership campaign.
And that's brilliant. So I think we covered a lot of debates there, and hopefully a good primer for the debates to come in the next few weeks. And I'm sure you'll be doing long reads and stories out of them in the Sunday Times.
Definitely.
Thanks so much for joining us, Harry.
Pleasure, absolute pleasure.
Maybe we'll do a special where me and you go up and we can debate something, whether it's a 2000 tax claim or...
sounds good to me.
Or what's in the Sunday Times. That's it for me, and we're going to do the battle bus next, so hopefully that'll be fun, another part of the election. We'll look at manifestos and so on. I can't remember all the things that Jonathan used to do at the end, which is... thanks for listening. Please share, review, and follow us on Twitter at whitehallpod.uk. So hopefully I've not screwed up Jonathan's legacy and got that right. Thank you.